I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
We start with some of today's developments in the war with Iraq.
As U.S. forces continue to advance toward Baghdad, President Bush spoke to troops at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina this morning.
We're on the advance. Our destination is Baghdad, and we will accept nothing less than complete and final victory.
U.S. Central Command confirms today that an F-15 fighter jet was hit, resulting in the death of at least one U.S. soldier in what the military says may be an incident of friendly fire. Other soldiers are reported wounded or missing in connection with that incident. Also, the military continues its search and rescue mission for the pilot of another fighter jet that went down during a bombing run over Iraq.
And last night, 7 crew members were killed and 4 wounded when their Black Hawk helicopter crashed south of Baghdad. The Pentagon now says that 51 Americans have been killed, 16 are missing, and 7 have been captured.
Also, this just in, reports that for the first time, large sections of Baghdad are without power following several explosions.
On the road to Baghdad, the U.S. 3rd Infantry Division's been the lead U.S. force. The Christian Science Monitor's Ann Scott Tyson's been with the 3rd for weeks now and joins us on the line. And what's the 3rd doing right now?
The goal at this point is to mainly block off entry and exit routes into the city. And I think there's a little bit of a wait-and-see attitude. I think there's a hope of some sort of internal collapse of the regime. I think there will be first an effort to completely isolate the city before any kind of urban combat would unfold. Remember, the 3rd Infantry Division is just doing one piece of this. There's also the Marines, and, the whole city has to be really cut off.
Ann Scott Tyson, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Ann Scott Tyson is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's reporting as an embed in the 3rd Infantry Division.
And now from the Northern Front in Iraq, we have WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Michael, tell us what you're seeing.
Well, Robin, I'm at Kalak, which is a town that has been underneath Iraqi guns. And today the Iraqis simply withdrew. There's been more than a week of fairly steady aerial bombardment, but nothing extraordinarily heavy. I was just up on the ridge that they withdrew from and was actually able to see the lights of Mosul coming on as the sun set. Mosul is the largest city in this region. Then the Peshmerga came to us and said, you better get off the ridge because the sun is set. And no sooner had the sun set than some artillery started going off around us. The operation here is very clear now. Peshmerga will hold positions within the Kurdish area or along its borders, and then special forces teams come in and are involved in bringing in airstrikes against the larger units of the Iraqi army.
Peshmerga, of course, being the Kurdish fighters. Well, you mentioned that you heard artillery fire. Who's firing at whom?
The Iraqis who had withdrawn have, it's said by some Peshmerga commanders that I was speaking with, they've moved about 6 or 7 kilometers down the ridge, and they began to fire back at the positions they've abandoned. The rounds have been loud and, in some cases, fairly close. People are out here are waiting to see when the U.S. Air Force is going to arrive and resume bombing those positions.
Well, what do you make of this, Michael? We know that U.S. forces are that much closer to Baghdad today. What do you make of Iraqi withdrawal?
I think that this goes to show that they are pulling back. They just simply can't afford to have men in positions of forward deployment around their cities. There's no way of knowing.
Right.
There's no way for me to know if they're heading for Baghdad.
Do I hear something overhead, or is that just the sound of the phone?
No, that was the sound of a car going by. but I can hear Robin as we speak, although it may not quite be loud enough. There were several loud bangs just in front of me. Now they seem to be firing, adjusting their fire.
Yeah.
You may have heard that.
Yes, I did.
That was rather a large artillery shell. I would expect that they're getting a position on that gun, and we'll have some airstrikes coming in shortly.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb from the Inside Out Documentary Division. For more on his reporting, go to our website, here-now.org.
Baghdad. It's a city with a foreign army now poised on its outskirts and a dictator, presumably still holed up somewhere in its urban heart. with 5 million citizens of Baghdad now in a kind of psychological vice between the U.S. armed forces and tens of thousands of Iraqi military and militia still believed loyal to Saddam Hussein. John Danishevsky of the Los Angeles Times is in Baghdad and joins us now. Welcome, John.
Hello, good evening.
John, we've been reading the past couple of days about a relative air of normalcy in Baghdad. Is that the case?
Well, that's been the case in the last few days, but today is a little different. The rumors are sweeping the city about how close the American forces are, and instead of aircraft overhead and anti-aircraft artillery, you're starting to hear regular artillery, sort of cannons booming. So people are aware that the armies are very close, and as a result, the city is very ghostly today. Very few people out, very few businesses open.
Is there fear in the city among average people that you can detect?
Well, yes, I think there is. People don't say so. They always, with a foreign journalist, they always are eager to say that we're not afraid. I just had a man tell me a little while ago that the Iraqi people are united like one fist. But if you look at their faces, if you listen to the tone of their voices, if you ask them about their children or their families, it comes across that especially these bombing, nighttime bombings can be very frightening, very loud. Things shake, and especially for people who live near targets, it can be very dangerous.
But streets more deserted than they've been for days.
Yeah, it really is a feeling of a calm before the storm. And people really don't know the intentions of the U.S. troops. They don't know, do they intend to storm the city, to come right into the center here? Are they thinking of having a long siege? The reports they've had from the south are not very encouraging because what they hear about mostly are the civilian casualties and the people who have been harmed. So it makes them rather nervous. There's a lack of information, credible information from their own authorities, so they listen to foreign radio broadcasts to try to figure out, and what travelers tell them to try to figure out where the troops are and what they're doing.
Finally, John, U.S. officials, military officials, have been saying that after the rout of large numbers of Republican Guard, some, maybe many, have slipped back into Baghdad. Do you have any way of observing that?
Well, I sort of had that impression a little bit today, too, when I was around. It just seemed to me that there were some people who look like they may have been soldiers or had slipped into civilian clothes out on the streets walking around. I think probably that is true. I'm not sure if they've done it in a sort of an organized, disciplined way or just a quiet, individual way.
John Danishevsky, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Baghdad.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
John Danishevsky is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. We spoke to him in Baghdad.
Well, the latest reports out of Iraq do say that American troops are all but knocking on the gates of Baghdad. But despite being less than 4 miles from the city, the Pentagon is saying that Americans should not expect a quick end to fighting. Joining us again to discuss the latest military developments in the war is retired Special Forces Colonel Khalif Sepp. Colonel, welcome back.
Thanks, Robin.
And, you know, as we hear, the forces are right outside Baghdad. And we should also note that reports are now, within the last few minutes, that power has gone off in much of Baghdad. And it's not sure if that's tied to explosions being heard again in the city. But some might ask, if forces are right there, what are they waiting for?
The sudden approach to Baghdad was simply unanticipated. What were intended to be probing attacks against the Republican Guard divisions that were several miles outside the city suddenly enjoyed success, and the commanders very boldly and correctly ordered their units to press on. But the rest of the units weren't positioned to move the entire force forward.
Well, Bill was just asking about which forces might be back in the city, and we're reading some analysis that says that the most important effort right now is not the American advance, but the U.S. effort to stop the Iraqi troops from retreating back into the capital.
That's correct, to try and keep them from reinforcing themselves. The Special Republican Guard, about 15,000, have probably always been inside the city. But these other smaller components of the surviving Republican Guard units could come into the city, reinforce their defenses, which are very problematic.
Yeah. What is next? I read one analyst saying, if it becomes all-out, hand-to-hand urban battle for Baghdad, then we've done something wrong.
Well, the very first thing that's got to happen, that's going to take several days, is the forces have to be moved forward, and that's one component, and the other is that logistics have to do their work and bring up enough supplies to sustain a major effort around the city, either a siege, as Mr. Rumsfeld has hinted at, or armed, very heavily armored forays into the city, which is what military commentator General Barry McCaffrey has called for.
Well, and how prepared are these forces for urban combat if it takes place? And what will urban combat look like?
The preparation is something that the officers and sergeants in both the American and British units have been in preparation for years. The British, who are down around Basra, have their very extensive Northern Ireland experience to draw on. What it will look like is going to be a lot like Black Hawk, the movie Black Hawk Down.
One would hope not. In some of those images that came out of Mogadishu, and we're hearing, that was a horrendous battle, but we're hearing that Baghdad has got wider avenues and less places for snipers to hide, and so that, in fact, it may not be as awful as some of the scenes from Mogadishu.
Well, the components that I'm not talking about a replay of Mogadishu, but the components of it, all the advantages that the Americans and British armored forces have enjoyed in the open areas, the extended range of their weapons, and the ability to fire tremendous amounts of artillery and bring in airstrikes without concern about destroying anything but the enemy targets that they're aiming at. Begins to go away in the city just because buildings are close to each other. That limits the visibility and the effective range of weapons. The advantage that the Americans have begins to go away and accrues more to the defender.
And speaking of the defender, in just the few seconds we have, what is the defense? Who do you think, from watching the Iraqi troops, is running the show?
This is a point of debate. Just because they're going to be compressed inside the city, Baghdad has for years been preparing itself and hardening itself against airstrikes, would indicate on the one hand that there would be redundant communications. On the other, everything that's happened up to now indicates that the Iraqi chain of command and their communications to units is very uneven and broken.
Well, Colonel, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Raman.
Khalid Sepp, retired Special Forces Colonel.
Just ahead, Congress debates Homeland Security funding. Some lawmakers wonder why Wyoming's slated to get more money per person than New York.
Also, voices from the Pennsylvania heartland on the war.
And later, controversy over the Bush administration's pieces already in place for a post-Saddam Iraq.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
This week, Republicans and Democrats in Congress are fighting over how much more to pay for Homeland Security this year and how to divvy it up among the states. Officials in New York say so far the divvying has been out of whack. An average of $1.40 per person is currently being spent to enhance security among New Yorkers. Wyoming receives seven times more per person.
Now, even Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge says the funding formula has been flawed. Joining us now is James Walsh. He's a congressman from Syracuse, New York, and he's the top Republican on the House Appropriations Committee. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
Congressman Walsh, what's the formula for allocating funds? How does it happen that New Yorkers end up with $1.40 per capita while Vermonters end up with $8.15 per capita?
Well, it's fairly complicated, but all states get a certain amount of money, regardless of their population, and then an adjustment is made based on population. That's why a small state would get proportionately larger amounts of money than a large populous state. But I think everyone here knows, I think most people in the country know, there are two real targets of opportunity for terrorists, New York City and Washington, D.C. And so the formula is flawed, and we decided rather than try to change the formula, we set aside about $700 million that would be provided to areas that had high threat, high density urban areas with critical infrastructure. And what that language says, in effect, is New York City and Washington, D.C.
How much more money do you expect New York State will get in this budget as compared to the last budget for Homeland Security?
We should be able to provide somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million to New York State, New York City.
And that's enough. Mayor Bloomberg asked for $900 million.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tough calls on these budgetary matters.
They are.
Yeah.
Especially with the war on.
Now, some leaders from small states say that they need more money because they have smaller police departments, for example. They have less security in their state, and in new times, they need new levels of security. What do you make of that?
Well, it's an argument that's as old as the nation. How do you make sure that states are treated equally when you have larger equals? And it's something that will be probably another compromise, but hopefully Syracuse is not nearly the high-profile target that New York City is, and I think most people understand that.
I want to press you just a little bit more, Congressman, on the question of how it is, how could it be that states that say they need a certain level of protection and they need federal help to pay for it would not get precisely what they need? It seemed, what higher priority could we have?
You know, these are compromises, and we need to, in the hearings process, make sure that we address the needs of the states and try to be as exact as we can in meeting those needs. There's no science here, and we will just have to meet the needs as best we can.
Congressman, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Congressman James Walsh is a Republican from New York State.
What are you doing, Gwen?
We're trying to get this aerial out.
I recently attended a 6-year-old birthday party in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Happy birthday to you.
In the next room, two 13-year-olds prepare for their rite of passage, the 8th grade performance of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing.
It's basically romance comedy, right?
Yeah.
And we've been working really hard on it, so.
Do you know there's all sorts of other stuff going on in the world?
Well, I've been trying to focus as hard as I can on the play, but it is a little bit distracting with what's going on.
What is your name?
Baraccio.
Write down Baraccio.
I found Phoenixville to be a small town with parents ferociously carrying out their kids' daily routines.
Provides us with hope for the future.
Despite the news.
Despite the news. Although the news is...
Over at the gleaming silver Val Real Diner in Phoenixville, families gathered as usual in the back room. At the front counter and booths, diners enjoyed coffee, a cigarette, and conversation. I sat down with owner Francis Pelio.
I think there's really a lot of confusion. There's the groups that come in here every day and debate what the government is doing and not doing. And I think a lot of people now are starting to get frightened because they're losing their jobs. So we have the cheapest meal in the world here. So actually, I think the diner business has been increasing quite rapidly. But that means the economy is falling quite rapidly at the same time.
That's how you see it. Do you mind if I stick my head in the back just to get diner sound? Yeah, I'll go with you so I don't knock anybody over.
The interesting thing is most of our help is from the Egyptian countries.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Oh, yes. That's from the satellite. And that's, what satellite's that you get your news from?
Oh, I have the Egyptian satellite. So, like, you get Arabic news?
Is it like Al Jazeera?
Yes, Al Jazeera.
You're watching Al Jazeera in the diner here in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania?
It's not just Al Jazeera. There's other couple of channels in there.
How large is the Egyptian population here?
Not very large, but we find the help to be excellent. They're outstanding workers. He started when he was 18. They're dedicated, and we're very proud of them, actually.
Back out front, opinions are served up with the home fries.
I don't support it. I don't support it. The UN doesn't support it, and I don't.
Other people here at the diner, do they talk much about it?
Everybody in here. I said, you guys always go over there and fight the goddamn war. You guys always go over there and fight it. Don't say anything to me because I've been through this. I've been through it. I'm for our troops.
With me, I didn't really watch it too much until after I found out that my cousin was in it. And he flies the bomber plane, and I was really upset about it. And I'm upset with it anyway because I didn't really want to go to war. We're there now. There's nothing we can do about it. But, I mean, I wish that it would just end real quick.
An audio postcard from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, a venerable voice of the left, Village voice writer Nat Hentoff, on why he's not protesting the war with Iraq.
Also, Sigourney Weaver in the story of a journalist who helps write eulogies for fallen 9/11 firefighters. The Guys, that's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community. On the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the growing rift between the State Department and the Pentagon on just what a post-Saddam government in Iraq should look like.
And a new Frontline documentary looks at the war in Iraq and its ramifications for Great Britain.
The point about the whole Iraq crisis for America, for Europe, for Britain, is that it's much bigger than a war over Iraq. It's about the shape of the world to come.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. The United Nations will have a role in post-war Iraq, says Secretary of State Colin Powell, but it remains to be seen what that role will be. Powell has been in discussions with European Union and NATO officials in Brussels, Belgium. The Secretary of State says the U.S. and other nations must put aside their differences to help the Iraqi people. The Bush administration advocates limiting the role of the U.N. to mostly humanitarian aid. With U.S. forces closing in on Baghdad, Saddam Hussein is urging the Iraqi people to fight with their hands. That's according to a statement read by Iraq's information minister on TV today. Meanwhile, U.S. officials say it appears Iraqi forces are on the verge of collapse as army troops move toward Baghdad from the southwest and marine units advance from the southeast. President Bush spoke at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina this morning in a pep talk to the U.S. Marine Corps there. The president reaffirmed his administration's support for the Iraqi invasion and mourned the loss of U.S. soldiers, some of which came from Camp Lejeune.
No one who falls will be forgotten by this grateful nation. We honor their service to America, and we pray their families will receive God's comfort and God's grace.
President Bush restated the nation's goal of not stopping until Iraq is free and said that we would finish what we had begun. U.S. military officials say one soldier has been killed and others are missing or wounded in a possible friendly fire incident involving a fighter jet and ground troops. No other details have been released. And the Pentagon is not ruling out friendly fire in the downing of an Army helicopter and a Navy jet in Iraq yesterday. Six Americans died in the incident involving the helicopter. The pilot is listed as missing in the other. The World Health Organization says the outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome in southern Guangdong province in China may be slowing down. The mysterious flu-like illness has killed nearly 80 people, half of them in Guangdong. There have been cases reported in the U.S., but so far, no deaths. The U.S. House has passed a bill that would deny Social Security benefits to fugitive felons or parole violators. The measure would also increase protections for Social Security recipients, such as minors or the disabled who have a legal financial representative in charge of their benefits. The U.S. Senate will consider the bill later this spring. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 19 points at 8266, and the Nasdaq is up a fraction of a point at 1397. It's 33 minutes past the hour. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This news just in. Associated Press is quoting U.S. military officials as saying that U.S. forces have attacked Baghdad International Airport. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Colin Powell met with NATO allies and members of the European Union in Brussels today, assuring them the United Nations will have some role in the reconstruction of a post-war Iraq.
There will definitely be a U.N. role, but what the exact nature of that role will be remains to be seen. We are hopeful that the Secretary General will, in the very near future, appoint a coordinator who can work with the coalition and work with the interim authority when it is created, to supervise the flow of humanitarian aid coming from UN organizations, and also serve as the eyes and ears of the UN in the area.
While Secretary of State Colin Powell was unsure what the UN's role might be, European leaders were adamant that the United Nations should take the lead, share a common vision, and that a post-war Iraq should, in the words of British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, be handed over as quickly as possible to the Iraqi people. In addition, diplomats outside the meeting suggested that anti-war allies, France, Germany, and Belgium, might accept a NATO peacekeeping mission, similar to NATO's role in Bosnia and Kosovo. NATO Secretary General Lloyd Robertson was hopeful that a peace mission could happen, but added that first, there must be NATO agreement on just what the UN's role in rebuilding Iraq will be.
As coalition troops battle their way across the sun-blasted desert outside of Baghdad, another group, also mostly American, sits at a beach resort in Kuwait. This so-called Office of Humanitarian Assistance and Reconstruction is the Iraqi government in waiting. Led by a retired U.S. general, these few hundred officials and their handful of Iraqi advisors will be responsible for feeding Iraq in the post-war period, starting to rebuild its infrastructure and ultimately installing a new regime. But reports say the office is thick with tension between the Pentagon and the State Department, what everyone in the office may share, concern about how Iraqis will welcome them when they arrive in Baghdad to take control. Susan Glasser is a Washington Post reporter. She joins us on the line from Kuwait City. Hello, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks very much for joining us. Susan, how much is how they will be received weighing on the minds of the men and women who are about to form Iraq's post-war government?
Well, I think this is a key question, just as the military perhaps is reevaluating and encountering resistance they did not expect in Iraq. I think that inevitably the few hundred people who are here in Kuwait waiting to come in on the heels of the military are watching and wondering what their reception is going to be and perhaps retooling their plans, rethinking what will be possible in the immediate post-war period.
Complex as the new architecture of a post-war Iraq will be, can you briefly describe for us how the post-war government will function?
That's an excellent question. I'm not really sure, and I don't think they are really sure. I think it's very much a work in progress. I should also say this is a very, very secretive group that has refused to speak publicly at all about the plans that they're making here. So, you know, we're operating in a little bit of a vacuum here, in part because I do think there's a great dispute going on inside the American government over how this post-war is going to work. But the basic idea is that this retired general, Jay Garner, would come in, take control as the first civilian administrator of the country, that there would be three deputies underneath him responsible each for an area, one for the north, one for Baghdad, one for the south, and that one of the key functions and which they are paying a lot of attention to right now is how to go in and immediately take control of the Iraqi government ministries, get them up and running as soon as possible, find out which officials in those ministries they can work with below the level of the senior Ba'ath Party ideologues. And I think the idea is that there would be a senior American advisor, they hate the term shadow minister, but in effect, that's probably what it would be, in charge of each one of the ministries.
Who is Jay Garner? Tell us about him.
Also a good question. He is a retired general. His previous Iraq experience was as the leader of the Operation Provide Comfort in the north of Iraq at the end of the Gulf War when the rebellion and fighting broke out there and there were a huge refugee problem. So, you know, he does have a connection, a close connection to the country in some way, but he's, again, been a very close figure, has not spoken openly about his plans or interests going into this, and he's been handpicked for this job by the Pentagon.
General Garner has stressed to his staff that the post-war occupation should last about 90 days. What do you make of that, and do you think that's on target, or is it going to take longer?
Well, that's right. General Garner has consistently told his staff here that, you know, that's their goal, is to work themselves out of a job within 90 days. I think people, however, are pretty sanguine about that and not convinced that that's really possible, given, you know, the difficulties they're inevitably going to encounter on the ground.
You know, Susan, to administer post-war Germany, the Allies kept many former Nazis in positions of authority as administrators, as judges. What's the sense about keeping on some former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party?
Well, I think you've hit on what is perhaps the most sensitive long-term issue facing these guys as they think about coming into the country, which is what will be the de-Ba'athification process and how extensive does it have to be? In part, my sense is that they don't really have full information about how much of a house cleaning they have to do. They don't really know who are people that they can work with versus people that need to be taken out of the government in some way. I think that the intent is clearly to leave a large part of the government infrastructure operating. because they don't see any other way to do it without creating even greater chaos. But they're also talking at the same time about some sort of Milosevic-type trials for people at senior levels of the Hussein government.
Hmm. Susan, in the minute or so we have left, how serious is the tension we hear about, we read about, between Pentagon officials and State Department officials?
I think it's absolutely very serious, and it involves probably two of the most key issues right now facing this Garner Group. The first of it is humanitarian assistance and who actually is going to be in control of supervising that. Secretary of State Colin Powell had to actually write a letter this week reasserting that it's his view that the emergency assistance team that is already here on the ground in Kuwait from the USAID should continue reporting to USAID and not to the Pentagon. There's great fear of compromising humanitarian assistance by placing it totally in the control of the Pentagon and the military. So that's one issue, and that's a very serious issue. And the second issue is the government ministries, and Donald Rumsfeld has vetoed the State Department's choices for the ministries that they were supposed to be involved with, and that obviously indicates a level of real gridlock inside the U.S. government on these post-war issues.
Susan Glasser, thank you so much for joining us from Kuwait.
Thank you.
Susan Glasser is with The Washington Post. She spoke to us from Kuwait City.
Still to come, Prime Minister Tony Blair, he failed to build pre-war bridges. What is his post-war future?
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Attorney William Smith of Framingham, Massachusetts, heard our interview with a military lawyer about attorney soldiers advising troops on the rules of engagement. William writes, "You ask a question saying lawyers have clients and in the military the client is the military commander. This is a mistake government lawyers often make. The client for a government lawyer is the people of the United States. The government lawyer has no business advising agents how they can best avoid the consequences of improper conduct or how to push the envelope on what the law requires of them."
Well, Howard Kurlansky wrote to say he listens every day and really enjoys the show, but adds, "Please don't repeat the when will it be over and how much will it cost mantra. You're beginning to sound like the kids in the back of the van who can't wait to get to the zoo." As Rumsfeld said, it's unknowable. "I hate the whole war and the diplomatic failure that brought us here. But now that we're in it, how about some objectivity in reporting what we do know, rather than endless debate over how many angels can fit on the head of a pin?"
Christopher Mader of Northborough, Massachusetts, left this voicemail about what he feels is too much negative reporting on the U.S.-led war effort.
"We've managed to secure 95% of the airspace around the entire country, secure airfields, oil fields, avert a humanitarian disaster, supply aid to insurgencies. And out of 300,000 troops, we've only lost maybe about 40 to 60 troops total. And people think the war is going badly? Man, this country's getting soft."
Following our interview with South Carolina Republican Congressman J. Gresham Barrett, who voted for a resolution calling on Americans to observe a day of humility, prayer, and fasting in this time of war, Mark Henn of Durham, New Hampshire, wrote, "I'm grateful you asked the congressman what a day of humility and prayer might mean for atheists. As an atheist, I suggest that instead of a day of humility and prayer, a day helping a homeless shelter or picking up trash. It's not as easy as doing nothing, but it makes a real difference."
A lot of you wrote with concerns that our story on the origin of the bombing term shock and awe would be untruthfully linked to a Hebrew word. Listener Kay Brendan writes, "I was one of those concerned about the initial promo, but I felt you hit exactly the right note. In fact, the laughing dismissal from your guest about a supposed Hebrew link could not have been more appropriate."
And regarding our interview with fired newsman Peter Arnett, Soroya Bandelli writes, "While Arnett is being questioned on his loyalty, no one is judging other reporters who are extreme to the other end of the spectrum. Their reporting is so pro-USA that it makes me seek out more objective reporting from the BBC and other international media instead of falling for all the propaganda as Mr. Arnett rightly called it.
And finally, we heard from several listeners who loved hearing Sir Edward Elgar's cello concertos and other classical music related to war. But they felt we left some out. If you did as well, let us know. We'll follow up.
Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Comment on anything. Include your name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been George Bush's strongest European ally in the war against Iraq. But as a new Frontline documentary points out, in the last 2 years, Blair not only faced war in Iraq, but attempted to stop the impending divorce between the sparring U.S. and Europe. And, well, as they say, no good deed goes unpunished. Blair's role cost him at home and abroad. The Frontline film is called Blair's War. It gives us an opportunity to talk about the beleaguered and fascinating British leader. And executive producer Eamon Matthews joins us on the line to do just that. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, your documentary starts right after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. It runs through the first bombs dropping on Baghdad. And I'm guessing that you didn't call it Blair's War just in reference to Iraq.
No, I think the point about Tony Blair is that when 9/11 happened, he saw an opportunity. He realized that the war against terror, possibly the war against rogue states, was going to become a defining issue of his premiership. And he thought he could become the bridge between Europe and America through the United Nations, bringing the British public along with him. Very idealistic stuff, but it's the way he works. He's quite a moral guy, and he saw this as an opportunity to do something that would get him in the history books.
Well, and as your film says, and as many note, he failed.
He's paid a terrible price. Strangely enough, his calculation with regard to George Bush worked. He got George Bush to go down the UN route. Where he failed, actually, was with the Europeans. It's long been a given in British foreign policy that the French will try and squeeze as much out of a situation as they can, that they will always bargain hard, they will use their position at the UN, but in the end, they'll come around. And this time, they didn't come around.
Yeah. But, you know, this marriage of the U.S. and Europe, with Britain as, if you will, the pastor, began well. And Blair shows up in New York to stand with Mayor Giuliani. President Bush acknowledges Blair in his speech to Congress. America has no greater friend than Great Britain. Thank you, my friend, that great moment. But then the Bush administration decides to go it alone without NATO. President Bush begins using language that resonates terribly in Europe. Let's listen to some thoughts from a Le Monde editor that you speak with in the film.
People were sort of afraid of introducing this religious language in the political landscape. Maybe they are cynical, maybe they are realistic, but that kind of language is very sounds very odd for us, very bizarre, and it does not cross well the ocean.
Was that one of the moments where it began to turn?
Yeah, the Axis of Evil speech is fundamental to understanding how what started as a little crack between Europe and America turned into a chasm. One thing which is really important to understand is that in America, people are religious. People go to church. People aren't frightened of talking about good and evil. You would never get a European politician using that language. They're frightened of certainties like that. There's too much history in Europe and too much recent history where leaders said, this is good, this is bad. Yeah. Now, interestingly, Tony Blair had less trouble with that speech. Blair himself takes a moral view of things. He is religious, unusually among European politicians. So he felt much more comfortable with Bush's rhetoric.
Well, some Americans would argue with your premise that all Americans are comfortable with it. But moving on to another moment in the film where it's obvious that Blair has become incredibly embattled, lost so much support. He appears on a talk show and has an exchange with what appears to be an average, everyday British citizen. Let's listen to that.
I would like to ask, do you believe that the people of your country are behind you at the moment?
I think if there were a second UN resolution, then I think people would be behind me. Mm-hmm. I think if there's not, then there's a lot of persuading to do.
Because I don't share any confidence that the people are behind you at the moment. Everybody that I've spoken to within my circle oppose what's happening at the moment.
Eamon Matthews, tell us, where does Tony Blair stand now?
I think he's a wounded political beast. What's been devastating about what's happened in the last few months is that a lot of the people who have turned against him come from his heartland. And, of course, also some of his closest political allies have turned against him. He is very much a hostage, not only to the fortunes of war, but to what happens in Iraq after the war.
Hmm. Well, that brings me to, there are now reports that Germany is forming a core Europe, or they're calling it more Europe, in which France and Germany will lead Europe. There's a meeting scheduled for April 29th, and right now Britain isn't invited. Do you think Prime Minister Blair's situation will change if pictures begin coming out of Iraq of happy Iraqi citizens greeting allied British or U.S. soldiers, as we're starting to see?
That will have a tremendous impact. Blair, all the way along, has said, trust me, I'm doing what's right. It may be unpopular, but trust me. And if in a month, 2 months, 3 months' time, people look back and say, well, we disagreed with him, but he was right, then his position is going to be stronger than ever. Mm. But one thing that's going to happen after this whole crisis is over is that the Europeans, and the British in particular, are going to think very hard about the price they pay, either for being with the Americans or for being against the Americans. Because for the first time in living memory, really, the British, for example, have to choose between Europe and America. The point about the whole Iraq crisis for America, for Europe, for Britain, is that it's much bigger than a war over Iraq. It's about the shape of the world to come. It's about who will rule that world. Will it be done through international institutions, or will it, in effect, be America that does it?
Well, Eamon, before we let you go, you covered the first Gulf War. You spent a great deal of time in Baghdad before being expelled by the Iraqi government. Your thoughts on the campaign for the city?
I was convinced, and I hold my hands up about this, I was convinced that the Iraqi people would take to the streets and cheer. People are just being very cautious. They want to see that this time it really is happening. And even then, I think they will be cautious because there's going to be clearly a U.S.-run government for a while. But they'll be thinking, what happens in 2 years' time?
I'm thinking Tony Blair is asking the same thing. Eamon Matthews, thank you.
It's been great to talk to you.
Eamon Matthews, executive producer of Blair's War, a new Frontline documentary airing tonight on PBS stations around the country.
Before we go, this summary of the day's developments.
U.S. military officials say an attack on Baghdad International Airport is underway. Pentagon officials are holding a news conference at this hour on the latest movement. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld reports troops have captured outlying areas of Baghdad, and some Republican Guard units are surrendering.
Electricity is out in large sections of Baghdad following loud explosions on the outskirts of the city. It's not yet known what's caused the outage, which is the first widespread electrical failure since the war started.
The U.S. military is investigating a second, possibly friendly fire incident against one of its own jets in the past 12 hours. One soldier on board an F-15E fighter jet is confirmed dead. Others reported missing or wounded.
The Iraqi information minister read another statement today from Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, urging the Iraqi people to fight with their hands against coalition troops, and compared them to a snake in the desert that has no foothold.
And this note, Edwin Starr died today. Starr was a soul singer whose career spanned five decades, but he was perhaps best known for his 1970 hit, War. Starr died of a heart attack at his home in England. He was 61 years old. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.